How does Sarah Palin stack up on diversity in her own state, and do ex-cons deserve a place at the polls? With us on our Bloggers Roundtable, we've got media consultant Carmen Dixon, who writes the blog All About Race, former Los Angeles Superior Court Judge Kevin Ross. He blogs at Three Brothers and a Sister and hosts The Kevin Ross Show on Blog Talk Radio. And Mark Lamont Hill, a professor of American Studies at Temple University. He blogs at marklamonthill.com and The Root. He's also a Fox News contributor. Welcome, everybody.
Hey, Farai. How are you?
Great to be here.
I am doing great. So it has been a little over 2 weeks since John McCain chose Sarah Palin as his running mate. The Palin pick has given the GOP a slight bounce in the polls, mostly with white women voters. So what about Palin's appeal to African Americans and black women? Now, only about 4.5% of the population in Alaska is black. But some bloggers are noting that Palin has no African Americans in her administration. The head of the state's African American Historical Society says the governor has not participated in any Juneteenth event. One recent headline by the Alaska blogger Amy Jones reads, "Does Sarah Palin understand diversity?" We're going to get Kevin in a second to issues also with the Native community, but just knowing what you've read about, the black community, does she understand diversity?
I can't say yet. I will say this. As a Republican, I like her. I like the fact that she is this kind of perky pit bull. And I like the fact that she's bringing a certain dynamic that but for Obama, she wouldn't even be invited to the party. I'm real clear about that. But as a black Republican supporting Barack, I find it very suspect that her lack of knowledge, I mean, her lack of intellect as it relates to these issues is considered charming, whereas Barack's intelligence is viewed as being suspect. And those issues of race, when we talk about Juneteenth as an overall celebration, I don't really care if she doesn't go or not. But the issue really is one of, does she have a certain level of sensitivity for African-Americans, black folks in Alaska, that for them, that's a big deal. So if she can't come, if she doesn't have anyone in her administration that reflects this diversity of Americana, that's a problem for Republicans. And I think it's going to come back to bite her in her pit bull butt.
She's got a lot of kids. She can send one of them. Carmen, what about the issues with Native communities? I mean, her husband is part of one of the Native tribes, one of the Inuit tribes. And yet at the same time, there are criticisms that her policies are not friendly to Alaska's Native Americans. What do you make of that?
Well, I think the broader issue is that her policies seem to be most friendly to people she's familiar with, no matter what their lineage. If you're part of her tribe, so to speak, if she knows you from high school, or if she thinks you are a supporter, then you're in. And if she doesn't know you, she doesn't seem to have the curiosity or the interest in reaching beyond what's extremely comfortable in her intimate realm. And that's what really concerns me, bigger than if she understands black people or even the diverse populace of her own state. It's that I am concerned that she doesn't care to understand them.
The nepotism.
Yes. It's not that she doesn't understand them. I get no sense that she cares about understanding or expanding places at the table or sees any value in increasing the number of voices who contribute to how she solves problems for Alaska and, Lord knows, for America.
Mark, you know, a month ago, most people didn't even know who this woman was. So how can we make a good decision about what her views are or aren't and how she treats people or doesn't treat people?
Well, I think we have to look at the past record. I mean, a lot of the critique against Barack Obama has come from his Senate voting record and his voting record at the level of the state Senate. So let's look at what Sarah Palin has done as mayor. Let's look at what Sarah Palin has done as governor. And what we've seen is she's gone to extravagant lengths to avoid diversifying her cabinet, to providing opportunities at tables, Carmen said. But also she's actually pulled away opportunities. Her cabinet is less diverse than the previous administration. You know, her decision not to support or even send a letter of appreciation to the Juneteenth events marks the first time a governor has ever done that in recent Alaska history. That's not simply indifference to diversity. That's not simply not caring about diversity. She wants to send a message to the world that she does not care about diversity partly because she understands that when you send that kind of message out, it mobilizes the right. It mobilizes her base. The same way when George Bush comes out against affirmative action on Martin Luther King's birthday, he understands that our reaction will actually stir up a certain sector of the Republican Party that actually enjoys enjoys that type of
But, Mark, I have to disagree with you because on some level, when you compare her to George Bush, I mean, the fact of the matter is
just the tactic, just the tactic.
Well, but even the tactic itself, when you look at someone who's been in office not even 2 years, I get the fact that, you know, having run for office, having been involved in political circles, irrespective of race or gender, people bring to the party the folks that they know and they're most comfortable with from a standpoint of, look, I have a vision. Are you on board or not? It just so happens that her circle, and I would probably suspect that many African Americans in Alaska are not Republicans. So we have to really look at that and say, before we start comparing her to these national politicians that have a record, that have had an opportunity to show that they understand the importance of diversity, I just don't think that she's had enough time, and that's actually something to her detriment.
But at what point?
But how much time?
But how much time then? She was, you know, she was a small town mayor before she was a governor.
Yeah,
how
but,
much
I mean,
time?
But Wasilla was what, all of maybe six people? I mean, so unless
But if we're going to count that record, we're going to count it.
Well, right. But I think first what we have to do is how many black folks were in Wasilla? Because if not a lot of black folks were in Wasilla, and then she then wins the statewide office, and she's only been in not even 2 years. Now, had she had been, see, my issue with her is she's not ready yet. Because had she served maybe a couple of terms as governor, and then we didn't see appointments in terms of judges or people on various commissions and so forth, and they all look the same, I think the argument can be made stronger that she doesn't get it.
I'm talking about right. tribes, though, not simply black folks.
Okay.
Exactly. She's had the same disposition toward Native populations in Alaska, which are far more plentiful than black folk. And she still has shown an indifference to diversifying her cabinet or providing opportunities or expanding opportunity in the social sphere for those people. There's no reason to think that she would, if she had four more years or six more years as governor, that she would do anything different. And if she would, that's an argument, as you said, for why she shouldn't be vice president, because she hasn't even sort of displayed any type of sensibility toward these issues. But I would add that most people, even as a matter of just public perception, will diversify the cabinet at the beginning. Even George Bush, even Bush and Cheney had a more diverse cabinet than what we're talking about here. I think at the beginning of your cabinet, you set a table. You set a standard.
All right, guys. Well, we are going to have to come back to you. We know you have a lot to say. We've been talking to bloggers Carmen Dixon, Kevin Ross, and Mark Lamont Hill. We've got more from them on our Bloggers Roundtable after the break. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. We're back with our spicy bloggers roundtable. With us is media consultant Carmen Dixon, who writes the blog All About Race. Former Los Angeles Superior Court Judge Kevin Ross, he blogs at Three Brothers and a Sister. And Mark Lamont Hill, a professor of American Studies at Temple University. He blogs at marklamonthill.com and The Root. And Mark, I'm going to, you know, jump right into this with you. There's been a number of different things coming out about affirmative action. One of them are some comments by Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, who spoke before an audience of black college presidents. Another one is questions about whether or not law schools are setting up people for failure by admitting them due to affirmative action. Another one is whether or not there are veiled ways to use race in affirmative action by indicating your race on essays, application essays. Now, you're someone who actually deals with admissions, and yeah. I'm not going to go through all the specifics of all of these different issues, but what do you think is the state of play in terms of how universities are trying to use or not use race in affirmative action on campuses?
You know, as someone who does admission and a doctor program at my university, I think one of the things that we take seriously is that idea that having a diverse student body actually enhances the educational experience of everyone, not just the black folk, but the white folk, the Asian folk. Everyone is enhanced when we have a diverse student body. I have seen, you know, we could probably say the median test score might be a bit lower for African-American students than some of their white counterparts. But in terms of the actual performance in the program, I see no difference. Their performance on high-stakes tests does not have any, you know, sort of bearing on how they negotiate the actual program. Some do really well. Some don't. Some students come in with in the 99th percentile in high-stakes standardized tests like GREs and LSATs and so forth and just flop in school. So I don't see any sort of relationship between those two. The one thing that I will say is in a place like UCLA, where we're beginning to see the holistic approach to applications where people are actually sidestepping or subverting legislation, I do see that as a problematic thing. When we have public policy, what we need to do is advocate for a better public policy. It's a wrong-headed public policy to say that people that we shouldn't consider race. But I think the way they're doing it right now in the back door actually ultimately hurts the larger project.
Kevin, there's one of these studies really looks at whether or not black law students are more likely to fail the bar exam on the first try.
They are.
And why do you think so?
I know for me, having gone to a black college, Morehouse, it was really interesting being in a situation where when I graduated, there were all these other black men. There were 12 individuals in my political science class. We all graduated and ended up going to law school and becoming lawyers. But when I graduated from law school in 1990, out of all the folks that graduated, I was the only black male to cross the stage. So here I am now preparing for the bar. I'm sitting in this room, and from a psychological standpoint, no one looks like me. And I'm feeling like this sense of, well, you know, black folks don't normally pass the first time anyway. So in my mind, I had to some extent psyched myself into believing that I couldn't pass. And sure enough, as in The Secret, whatever you put out there comes back. Failed that bar the first time. The second time I went, and I was like, oh, hell no. I'm doing this because I'm not going to have this sort of psychological battlefield going on in my own brain. And the black guy was actually sitting next to me, and he was chatting like, yeah, this is my 16th time. And I was like, brother, you know what? I'm here on a mission. I'm not trying to come back.
Yeah, it's like, I'll get you a coffee while you're working at Starbucks.
And you can't talk to me. So, and ultimately what ended up happening, even when I went to go use the bathroom, I ran to the bathroom and ran back. And I had my mints and I shaved and I got dressed. Because psychologically, black folks oftentimes believe we can't do it. And once we get into the mindset of a si se puede, yes, we can, we excel. And I think to some extent, people are not really taking into account the psychological remnants of slavery and our past.
That's a lot to deal with, Carmen. What should universities do? What's the university's role in trying to shape affirmative action policy? Not just for law students, but, you know, in general, should universities be taking race into account, which in some states like California, in public schools, they're not supposed to. In other places, it's just fine.
I have mixed feelings about it, to be quite honest. I think we are at a point in society where class-based affirmative action, to me, is more appealing because my classmates who graduated from Yale in the mid-'80s, everybody's doing fine. Their kids attend private school, have every lesson you can name. I can't see why, on the basis of the melanin in their skin or even their cultural heritage, they should be given any kind of special consideration. They've had the best of the best. They can compete on an even playing field. However, the other thing I will say is that I do believe that it contributes to an enhanced learning environment for everyone to have as diverse a student body as possible. How do you recruit that student body without referring to race? I don't know.
Right. I think one of the challenges, though, is even though there's nothing genetically that predisposes black folk not to do as well in school when we control for class, what we do know is that all the data suggests that even when you control for class in middle-class institutions, in private schools and independent schools, black students often don't fare as well as their white counterparts. I don't think, though, that that is a reflection of the students themselves and their innate ability or capacity to be smart or to do well in school, but it does have to do with the way school responds to black people irrespective of class. And so to some extent, we need racial measures because school is still such a racialized space in terms of curriculum, in terms of the way we teach people, in terms of policy measures, in terms of school discipline. All those things cannot be reduced to the level of class. And so while I agree that class is a critical issue here, we can't ignore the persistence of race as a factor.
We're going to have to actually go to one of the topics we wanted to talk about in a future segment, but we're going to be doing a lot of work on the issues of voting, voting rights, who gets to vote. Kevin, I'm going to go to you because there's a new push to return voting rights to ex-convicts in time for this presidential election. And there's really no one law. Each state or district gets to make up its own law. You have some places like Maine that say you can vote from prison if you're a felon. Mm-hmm. There are other places that say if you serve your time and you get out and you stay clean from crime, you still can't vote ever. Do you think this is going to be a big push? And is there even time to really address this before the election?
I think there is time. I'm involved with this Angel City Classic football event out here in Los Angeles. And aside from the Morehouse and Prairie View matchup, and they're going to battle all the bands, we're also doing something with Declare Yourself, which is an organization that is focused on making sure folks register. The bottom line is there are 8 million African Americans that are still not registered to vote. And you have a number of individuals, I believe something like 5 million, who have post-incarceration have the opportunity, but for whatever reason, they're not voting or they can't vote. I like what Republican Charlie Crist in Florida did with respect to dividing it into three categories: individuals who are nonviolent offenders, because most people, particularly people of color and women, are in custody because of drug offenses. Disproportionately, and small little things. You know, if you go steal a Snickers at a 7-Eleven, that's a petty theft. If you go and steal another Snickers a year later, that's a petty with a prior. That's a felony. So when we look at who gets to vote, I agree that individuals, if they're still on probation or parole, if they're still serving their sentences, maybe not. But all those individuals post-sentence and nonviolent offenses, we should be registering them. Republicans should be taking the lead on that, because it's starting to look as though we are trying to keep folks incarcerated out of the system, and I don't think that bodes well for our party.
Okay, guys. Well, we're going to come back and revisit this topic at length, but I want to thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
We have been talking with Mark Lamont Hill, who teaches American Studies at Temple University. He blogs at marklamonthill.com in The Root. He was at Audio Post Studios in Philadelphia, also former Los Angeles Superior Court Judge Kevin Ross, who blogs at Three Brothers and a Sister, and media consultant Carmen Dixon, who writes the blog All About Race. She also blogs for AOL Black Voices, and both she and Kevin were here with me at our NPR West studios. You can find links to their blogs and ours at NPR News and Notes.org. And the conversation doesn't stop there. Our online series Speak Your Mind gives you a chance to sound off on the issues you care about. To find out how, go to our blog, nprnewsandviews.org, and click on Speak Your Mind.